Hello, and welcome to Sci-Fi.
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 Yes, sci-fi, sci-fi, sci-fi. And we are this week talking about All the Birds in the Sky by Charlie Jane Anders.
Tweedle, delete.
Thank you. Okay, so from the back of the book, childhood friends Patricia Delphine and Lawrence Armstead didn't expect to see each other again after parting ways under mysterious circumstances during high school. After all, the development of magical powers and the invention of a 2-second time machine could hardly fail to alarm one's peers and families. But now they're both adults, living in the hipster mecca San Francisco, and the planet is falling apart around them. Lawrence is an engineering genius who's working with a group that aims to avert catastrophic breakdown through technological intervention into the changing global climate. Patricia is a graduate of El Tisley Mays, the hidden academy for the world's magically gifted, and works with a small band of other magicians to secretly repair the world's ever-growing ailments. Little do they realize that something bigger than either of them, something begun years ago in their youth, is determined to bring them together to either save the world or plunge it into a new dark age. A deeply magical, darkly funny examination of life, love, and the apocalypse. So, what did people think? Barry?
It was all right.
Yeehaw!
Well, there's a cover zinger for you. Kevin, do you have anything?
By the end of it, I did like it. It took me probably halfway or so to get into it. But when I re-listened to the first, you know, like I usually do, I'll re-listen to maybe the first hour of it before we record. And it made more sense kind of second pass.
Right.
I think it just took me a while to kind of understand what was going on, and kind of the childhood section of the book I wasn't super into until they grew up.
Yes. I'm starting to realize that perhaps liking or disliking a book is becoming an accident as to how many times one has read it.
You'll love it eventually.
Just keep reading it more and more and more, and you'll learn to love it more and more and more.
Including just like right now, I love the word more.
More.
More. More.
Anyway, I love this book, actually. I thought it was fun from the beginning. I thought that it starts out as sort of this quirky boy's own adventure, but with two characters from children's adventures in the beginning, one from a science fiction novel and the other from a fantasy novel. And both of them are gradually following the tropes of boy's own and girl's own, shall we say, adventure books. So we have Lawrence, the super engineer who develops a 2-second time machine, which is apparently just an ordinary thing that you can download the specs for online.
Yeah, you just need like a Taco sports watch and...
Yep. Then we have Patricia, who is a young witch who is gradually discovering the extent of her powers. And I thought that it was well explored and a lot of fun. And then it all sort of goes to hell in a fun way. More to the point, the book does have an ending. I almost feel like it's a spoiler to say that a book actually ends these days, but I have to give it points that it had an ending.
That's true. It seemed like it potentially was left open in some way, but it did actually end, as opposed to some other books we read recently that just sort of stop.
Right.
And it's like, oh, wait for part 2, 3, 4, and 5, and maybe more, depending on how much money I get.
Indeed. All right. So do we have anything else to say before we get into our discussion section?
Well, I did like... It has a very kind of colloquial feel to how it was written. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of like it was, well, this stuff happened and whatever, which is kind of, I guess, how I talk. So I at least found it amusing. Like, but also there was a lot of very blunt kind of meta stuff thrown in. Like instead of saying like, oh, and then her parents did some stuff that was kind of messed up, it was like, you know, they just said, oh, and her mom's like, well, could you just tell us, you know, I don't remember exactly, but, you know, could you just tell us if, you know, you're going to do something, because then we could just, you know, save a lot of money by giving up on you, and like, you know, stuff that, you know, people would never actually say, but it kind of like said the unspoken meaning of it as opposed to what they actually would normally say.
Yes. The subtext ramp. Let's just shove that right up into the text.
Basically. So I found that was funny. You know, I did kind of appreciate that, you know, and there were some definitely like, you know, it made it uncomfortable with some of the characters because they were saying stuff that you're like, oh, wow, well, that was pretty effed up. Like, it made a change, I guess, from most books.
Okay. Barry, anything else?
Nope.
All right, then we are going to take a short break and come back for our discussion section, where we will spoil this till the end of the world. All right, and we are back with our discussion of All the Birds in the Sky by Charlie Jane Anders. I guess we can begin with our usual question. Was there tea?
There was I thought they had met in like a tea shop or a coffee shop.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Good. We got that checked off.
Some sort of beverage place.
Do we have any favorite scenes we wanted to talk about? Well, it's been great talking about.
Yes, if I can remember it, I probably have one. But unfortunately, this was, you know.
This is another of our memory wipes.
Yeah, we read this a little bit ago. And then, you know, the holidays sort of got in the way of our recording.
Yes.
So, I mean, a couple of scenes that I remember, I wouldn't characterize them as favorite scenes. But there was sort of like a battle at the end between some sort of annihilation robot and the magician's group, right? Or the wizard's group, or I can't remember what the word was that they used for themselves, but.
Sure.
That one definitely stuck out. It was actually, you know, where the action really started to rise up in the book, and I actually started paying a lot more attention.
Mm-hmm. This is a kind of book that I'm surprised we don't see more of. It's a fight between technology and magic in which both sides are kind of equally represented in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's got a very subtle Shadowrun-like texture to it.
What makes it Shadowrun-like? I've never actually played Shadowrun.
Well, it's, you know, Shadowrun's also got the magic and the technology, and there's sometimes they're in conflict, but, you know.
Right.
Things happen. People get together for common causes.
Exactly. Here we have the magical side and the technology side, neither of whom are terribly good at talking to each other.
Internally or in between groups.
Exactly. Well, the one person that knows about both worlds has a spell put on him so that if he tells anyone non-magical about magic, he will not be able to speak forever.
Right.
Yeah. Physically speak. Right.
Yes. That was one thing that I was actually unclear on until it was revealed at the end is he can still write. So it's bad, but not terrible.
Yeah, right. It wasn't that he couldn't communicate. It's just he wasn't able to speak.
Exactly. So each side kept on thinking that the other was up to no good and kept on attacking the other towards the end as the world in general got worse and worse.
They were kind of right, but they were kind of the backup plans. But yes, it was.
And by worse and worse, I mean, it was pretty clear that, you know, climate change was sort of reaching its peak, right?
Right. As will never happen. This was a fantasy.
It is. There's no science to back this up.
Oh, God.
I'm here to help.
Now that he's in apoplexy. And
Steven is now turning red. He's drooling.
Mm-hmm. But that's just what happens to me on your average day, so nothing unusual about that.
It's kind of like a book where things happen day to day. It's like about day to day life. And then a lot of it is about personal relationships with people that don't know how to do them, which is probably most people. So
right.
People don't say things. People say things they don't mean. And people just sort of like, you know, go into themselves. And like, it's about two characters that basically grew up complete social misfits, you know, even more than probably any of us were, even though probably, you know, we were pretty big social misfits, I would guess, but in different ways.
Well, that was sort of my initial reaction to the first part of the book was, gee, I thought I was a social misfit growing up, but I had more than one friend.
Yeah. This is sort of
I had two.
Yeah, this is sort of one of those classic examples of, yes, it could be that much worse, you
exactly.
know, growing up.
You could have just been kept in your room with food literally passed under the door to you.
Yes.
I'm Lawrence with a U, and, you know, I'm a social outcast, even within my own family.
Exactly.
There was a strong message, at least, you know, from the family and, you know, even from the environment, you know, when they were growing up, about this is how you should be, and if you're not this way, then, you know, bad things.
Right. One thing I was having trouble figuring out was which period that this was set in some ways, because I always am getting the impression that you're not a jock, so you're a social outcast wasn't quite a big thing with kids these days, but I'm probably just wrong.
It's more of a, like, you know, 90s thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, this was supposed to be set, I assumed, somewhat in the future, but not a lot, unless it was supposed to be sort of a parallel, you know, branch or something. But
right. The parents seemed to have more sort of 1970s, 1960s kinds of attitudes.
Right.
You know, I assume that Charlie Jane Anders is about our age or maybe a little bit younger. So she might be basing that on some of her upbringing. I don't really know.
Yeah, I think that's definitely possible that, you know, this is maybe somehow a little bit of what the author was, you know, sort of experiencing.
So we have Lawrence, who moves ahead to a math and science school and falls in with a crowd of engineers. And we have Patricia, who gets the classic fantasy trope of being swept away to the magic school after a stunning escape. Right. And manages to, at several points, transform herself into a bird.
I actually thought it was kind of a funny transposition, right? You know, Lawrence gets sent off to this military school for a short period. And
right.
So then Patricia goes off to wizarding school, which turns out to really be more like a drill camp.
Right.
You know, and like just sort of what you would have expected for Lawrence's position, you know.
Right.
Except he ends up going off to math school and sort of having a great time, you know. And it's like this magic school, you know, they sort of have like these, you know, trial by fire experiences all over the place, you know, where she's sort of just dropped into a town and said, oh, you have to heal somebody. And, you know, they right. can't really know about it. What is it? She ends up hanging from a ceiling beam or something by her legs to help somebody out that really doesn't want her help.
Right, exactly. One of the big conflicts is the magicians see themselves more as the servants of nature. They don't really try to control things. They have power when they need it through some external means, whereas the technologists are trying to impose control on things. And I sort of thought that this was going to turn into, so we're going to jump up and down on technology because you shouldn't control things. But it turned out to be a lot more equal at the end than I really expected.
Yeah, I mean, it did turn out to be a very fair fight.
Mm-hmm. And I think part of it was that Lawrence kind of subverted that whole dichotomy. One of the things that sort of happens in the beginning and then drops out of the narrative and comes back is he creates an AI called Change Me. And this is usually a trope that really bothers me, but for some reason it didn't bother me as much in this one, which is that, the main character invents an AI, something that would completely change the world if anybody actually did that.
Right.
And it just is sort of a kid's prank or something like
hey,
that.
Hey, buddy.
But since he already had a two-second time machine that let him transport himself forward in time for 2 seconds, they had kind of rung that bell already that there's already a lot of stuff in this universe that you're going to find a little bit beyond what would be normally absorbed into reality. But anyway, he sets this AI basically free, or rather this AI kind of sets itself free.
Well, actually, isn't it Patricia who asks the AI to help sort of save Lawrence, and then
that's true.
It ends up sort of putting itself into the military school's computers, and it just sort of at that point it sort of disappears into the background after sort of setting Lawrence
right.
free, right?
Right. That was the big central point of the novel, and then it sort of drops into the background, and Lawrence sort of convinces himself that he had kind of dreamed the whole thing,
yeah.
given that at that same time his best friend had revealed that she was magic. It's something that you could paper over in your head relatively easily.
Yeah, I mean, the AI really sort of like served as a bridge between Lawrence and Patricia
right.
for quite a while, right? Lawrence had written the AI from a sort of a pure science background and then introduced Patricia to it and said, you know, just ask it questions. It's the only way it's going to learn or, you know, interact with it. You know, and her from being from the magic background, you know, sort of always asks sort of these more existential questions or
right.
things that Lawrence would have found very jarring or, you know, out of left field, and therefore the AI does, right? But then the AI is sort of bringing all these things together and,
right.
and really starts to blossom under their creation. It's like they're almost like their child or something.
Right. And the AI later says, well, that's actually what it took to create strong AI was first the AI has to be created, then it has to talk to a witch for a while.
Yeah.
There was one interesting scene where Patricia is describing some of the things that she does around town, and Lawrence says, well, what's your ethical framework? And I had this sort of feeling of both thinking that was an irritating question. It was also a question that I had asked of the narrative just a second before, which was, how do you rein yourself in when you have magic? If you're part of a secret society, what is your ethical relationship with ordinary people?
Self-aggrandizement or whatever
right.
it was.
I mean, their big thing was that you had to keep away from aggrandizement, thinking that you were the most important thing ever. And that was part of the whole problem that they had.
Which I think is also sort of a reflection on, you know, the tech side of it, right? It's like, how do you know when to stop or...
Right.
So I think that was sort of like the subtle point.
I don't fully understand.
You know, so I sort of think that the same arguments could be made for like a you know, what's the ethical framework for technology, right?
Oh, right.
I mean, I think that was sort of like one of the thought points that was, I wouldn't say it wasn't plainly said, but...
Sure. What was one of the recurring themes of the book is both of these are ways that you can get power. Right. And so the magicians are against aggrandizement, so they're pulling back from anything that makes them in charge and control the most important thing ever. The technologists are just trying to save humanity because they think of that as the most important part of Earth.
Right. And meanwhile, the AI is under the tutelage of both of them has gone off and become sort of some sort of like super advanced, you know, Tinder app and called the Caddy, I guess, was the product, which I thought was a car for the longest time.
It was a little bit
golf
like
Caddy, you know,
a little bit like her. It wasn't clear to me exactly what they looked like. It wasn't a phone. It was something a little bit more.
Yeah, they kind of said it. Yeah, it was just sort of this. It was a phone-like device, but
it's more like a phablet, I think. Type thing.
But they said it was kind of like a weird, like, you know,
it's like a weird shape right?
and stuff. So yeah, it was just your personal. I just kind of thought of it as a PDA, basically.
Right. I mean, I kind of imagined it as like a painter's palette or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, sort of had like that weird.
It's like a coin purse oval-ish shape or something.
And all three of us guessed fairly early on that the caddies were all Change Me, this AI that he had created and had gotten free, and it was something we were all wondering, is this one of those things where the writer thinks that they've pulled a fast one on the audience and the audience is just like, okay, so when is it revealed that Change Me is the caddy?
Yeah, I'm waiting.
Yeah. And to be fair, the first thing that the caddy says when Change Me is revealed to be inside it is, I thought you'd have figured this out by now.
Well, I mean, the AI does sort of disappear out of the book around, I'd say, like the one-third mark, right?
Right.
It doesn't really appear again till probably like the last part of the second third.
Mm-hmm.
So it does disappear for quite a while. And then I mean, for me, I felt like the book was sort of meandering quite a bit, sort of that middle third.
Yeah. Like I was having fun with it, but yeah.
I spent a lot of time really having to focus really hard on what I was listening to make sure I was picking up on what was happening. But, I did feel like my attention was drifting quite a bit there in that middle section there. But the last third was, hey, here we go.
When the end of the world comes, we know we can make it all better with madrigals.
You guys knowing me, you know which way I was leaning towards.
Yeah, it did wrap up very, very quickly, even though there was an ending. It was kind of like zoop.
Yeah, but I think it was a definite solid ending, I thought.
Right. It wasn't just a stop mid-sentence ending or a, well, maybe I'll write another book, so I'll stop here ending. It was like there was an actual conclusion, and you could leave it like this and never do anything more, and it would still be an ending.
Well, and also, I think that this should be called out because I see it less and less, is this is an ending that sort of gets stuck. Maybe it happened a little bit quickly, but this wasn't thing where, oh, okay, we have an ending and, ooh, story's still going. It made a bunch of promises in the beginning. It sort of said, okay, you know, we have a question that needs to be answered. Is a tree red?
And of course, being an audiobook, it's like, is that the color or is that, you know, how is that spelled?
Depends on which explain. Spectrum you're using to look at it.
Right.
Well, I was thinking this, there was a lot of anti-trope stuff going on where you were waiting, like, you know, kind of like Patricia says at the end, well, don't I get any power-ups? Yeah. You know, I answered your question.
Just like, nope, thanks, though. Good answer.
Yeah, there was a lot of that happened where you were expecting this to be a pivotal thing, and it wasn't, but they kind of, you know, occasionally make fun of the fact that, oh, you thought this was going to happen? Yeah, we're just continuing now. Like,
I did like that. Yes, by the way, the official answer that she gives in the end was, of course, I don't know, because the question is kind of stupid. And they sort of... The birds that have asked this question in the beginning sort of confer and said, that is an acceptable answer.
It did like, take you 30 years, though.
Right.
Right. Yeah, I did think it was funny that they did at least throw in the trope of the kids at magic school go off and do something wacky and someone gets injured in or killed.
But unlike in Harry Potter, this is actually a terrible thing.
Right. And
may have contributed towards the actual end of the world.
And the interesting thing was, you know, they kept saying, oh, she was the one who was leading it. And I don't think that was the case. She kind of went along with it.
I think she was more the fall girl.
Yeah, basically. But did she even say, I didn't do it? Like,
that's aggrandizement.
Yeah, that's kind of what it's what they seem to be saying. So, you know, no matter what you say, you know, you're just damned, I guess. And
Patricia told a lot of her friends about her early childhood encounter, which she wasn't entirely sure that she really believed anymore. And one of them sort of glommed onto that and said, oh, I too have spoken to this tree, and it said that we have to do the following mission. We have to go and destroy this natural gas pumping station that's going to possibly destroy the world.
Right.
The Dakota Pipeline?
No, that's a good idea. All hail the leader.
All hail the leader.
Opinions expressed on this podcast may not be actual opinions.
This book did definitely go in some interesting places, right? So it seems very, I don't want to use the word timely, but it seems like there's a lot of stuff that has happened in the last couple of years that has been woven into this book.
Sure, exactly.
You know? I mean, I was kind of joking about the Dakota Pipeline, but, you know, here we are. You know,
exactly.
It's in the news right now, and some awful things are happening. I mean, I don't see anybody going out there and blasting it with a lightning bolt, which may or may not be a good thing. I don't know.
If our civilization indeed has a future, then this will age well.
So I had another one where, you know, Lawrence needs something. I can't remember exactly what it was, but the exchange, the quid pro quo, was that I need the smallest thing you value.
Oh, yeah. It was when one of his friends got pulled into a black hole, essentially.
Ah, yes.
In which they had opened a portal to another universe. And
yeah. I was like, whoops, this was just supposed to be anti-gravity.
Yeah,
sorry.
Exactly.
You know, and of course, the first thing that I thought was like, oh my God, he just gave away his soul or something.
Right.
You know.
So, yes.
Which in some ways, a little bit of his soul was actually part of that.
Exactly. So the magic system is not very clearly defined here, but there's a heavy emphasis on transactions.
Well, yeah, they basically said there's the two main types. It's the trickster.
Right.
And the healing.
Right.
And that at the end we find out maybe that's not really the case, but that's kind of how they've been defined historically.
Right. And all the players could dabble in both, right?
Right.
It's just usually you had a leaning towards one or the other, and it turns out Patricia sort of had like a foot in both worlds there.
She was particularly strong, and she could do that. So, yeah, you would, if you trick somebody into something, into some transaction, then that's like a powerful energy source. So she's like, I tried all this stuff. I didn't want to do this, but you have to give me the smallest thing you own, you know? And then, you know, it's like his grandmother's ring that he was going to like, kind of, as he said, the nuclear option of like making his girlfriend not break up with him by proposing to her. but then now he has to give it to Patricia. And
this gradually sort of leads to his breakup with his girlfriend, even though his girlfriend didn't know about this ring.
Right. And I mean, I actually guessed that pretty quickly that they had dwelled on the ring.
There was a lot of time spent discussing the ring.
I thought, okay, you know, probably it's going to be that. And then he realizes it pretty quickly too. So they're like, oh,
well,
yeah, that's.
And Patricia says, yeah, I didn't know it would be that, but I knew it would be something like that.
Right.
Because that's just how these things work, I'm afraid.
Right. So she kind of knew what was going to happen roughly, you know.
Right. So she had to kind of trick him in a way, but she wasn't trying to. She just had no
other choice. That's just how it worked.
That's how it works. That's, you know, magic is transactional. In order to get something of value, he had to give up something of value.
Right. And basically they say, yeah, she could give it back to him, but then it would maybe, you know, his friend might go back into the black hole, or he might go back in the black hole, or something worse might happen. So, you know,
there's a potential to undo whatever good was done with the transaction.
Right.
As a magical system, I kind of like the exchange of values method. It keeps people from getting too overpowered in these kinds of books.
Right. And I mean, it is interesting when you think back to earlier in the book, how like the guy where his face changed every day, he would always like ask you for something, right?
Right. A little behind the scenes, we were all dying because Kevin was trying to remember the guy's name and was described him as the guy with the face, and then paused, and both Barry and I kind of lost it.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you, Kevin.
That changes.
That changes.
It's accurate.
He did have a face.
Well, I mean, a lot of the high magic people that were in this book definitely had some interesting powers and slash quirks, right?
Sure.
I mean, there was the guy with the changing face. There was another gentleman who, I guess, if he touched you, right? I mean, basically he could.
Right. And he basically made anything living grow to extremes.
Yeah.
So he was constantly covered with dirt, I guess.
Oh, was that, was why she said, don't let him touch you or something?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I think I missed that part. I was just like, okay, just going with it. But
yeah. And there was even like the sort of the outcast magician, right? Who was the school counselor, I think, for in the beginning.
Oh, he was an assassin. He wasn't actually a magician as far as I know.
But he seemed to understand what was going on there.
Right.
To a certain extent. Right. And then, you know, I guess he had some sort of crisis of faith where he couldn't kill a child or something.
So in the beginning, if you'll recall, so Lawrence and Patricia were out shopping and they were playing the game of looking at people and making stuff up about them just based on their shoes or something.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right.
And they said, oh, that guy, he's an assassin.
Oh, because he had silent shoes or something.
Something like that. And they made up this whole story and it just absolutely happened to be right. And so he was actually sent to kill them, but because they were going to lead to this world nearly ending.
Right. He had a vision or something and he was going to kill one or both of them. And he told Patricia that she had to kill Lawrence.
Right.
And in the future, like, you know, there'd be this big war between magic and science and
Somebody poisoned him because the one rule of assassins is you don't kill children.
Right. He was like going to, and they sent him like a little reminder, poison reminder, like, don't do it.
Which was this sort of bizarre little peek from a completely different novel, if you ask me.
Yeah. It did seem like it mostly went away, except that he came back later just to be an object lesson and sort of to be a little plot device, to remind her later.
He did show up later as sort of like a scuzzy homeless person, right? That like everybody else was kind of ignoring, but Patricia immediately, you know, recognized who he was.
And then I kind of missed exactly what happened. They turned him into kind of like a little living doll and kept him on her shelf or something. Like
yes, for a while.
I forget then, exactly.
I missed that part of it.
As happens.
Yeah, she showed him to Lawrence, right?
Right.
And he's like, oh, that was him?
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah.
That was our school guidance counselor.
He's like, yeah, that guy really messed both of us up or whatever.
I turned that jerk into a shelf elf.
I kind of just want to do that sometime. I'll go to one of my high school reunions and just have a small little sculpture and just say, oh yeah, remember our school guidance counselor? Here she is. Just like, we liked our school guidance counselor. Uh-huh.
And that has been a peek into Stephen's dark fantasies.
All right. And on that note, do we have anything final to say?
Madrigals.
I mean, so there was madrigal singing. I shouldn't let that go unspoken.
Well, they did say, you know, leave it to hipsters to even like, what was it? Either ruin madrigals or like pick the worst musical form, you know, I don't remember, something about hipsters messing something up again or what seemed to be the tone, but I forget
mess up?
It was just like a little thing thrown into there.
Yes, exactly.
Would you like to cover the point of
Cat? I didn't actually have time to read it, but apparently a lot of people wanted to know what happened to Patricia's cat, which was, you know, her childhood cat, and then she, you know, got yanked away to magic school, so the cat was still left at home. Well, apparently the author got this question quite a bit, so she wrote a short story that you can go find online.
It is more than two words, right?
It is a few pages at least, yes. Okay.
This has been a note to the other authors out there. Don't leave dangling
cats.
Dangling cats. Yes.
Hang in there, buddy.
People are invested.
Yes. Okay. Well, that has been another episode of Sci-Fi, Sci-Fi, Sci-Fi. If you like this podcast, please subscribe to us on iTunes. I've always wondered why other podcasts say, please subscribe to us on iTunes. Turns out iTunes counts up how many subscribers you have, and that's how a lot of your rankings are handled. So even if you don't listen to us on anything that involves iTunes, please feel free to subscribe to us on iTunes.
Good job.
Yay. Please. Until next episode, we are Sci-Fi.
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 Put it in the computer and see how jacked up it is. It's like the hardware is...